Hello, Damien Carrick with you. Today, tertiary students and the law. We look at contract cheating. That's where students pay someone to write their assignment for them.
Those students who are struggling at midnight on Saturday night and they're being inundated, I can't tell you how much, in social media by these commercial cheat sites saying, we'll do your work, we'll help you, let us write your assignment. You know, it's tempting to use those unethical services.
Also, if a student is accused of sexually assaulting or sexually harassing a fellow student, what processes should be followed? But before we get to issues around misconduct, we're going to look at the recent case of Monash University journalism student Chinmay Naik. His video journalism lecturer wasn't impressed with Chinmay's assignment, which was a current affairs-style story on negative stereotypes surrounding certain dog breeds. The lecturer gave Chinmay just a 12% mark. That's 12 marks out of 100. So what did Chinmay do? He took the matter to the Supreme Court of Victoria. Professor Sally Varnum, based at UTS Law School, is an expert in higher education and the law.
He'd passed everything up till then in his journal, and this is, I think, the last subject that he has to do. It was a video assignment about negative stereotypes around certain dog breeds. And he submitted it. It was marked, given a very low mark. Then he resubmitted it and they remarked it and the mark went up slightly, but still not enough for a pass.
I think it went to 21% when it was remarked.
Yeah. And there's a bit of an argument there that he raised to do with discrimination, because he said he was under a disability because he was having anxiety or depression problems. And he represented himself, which is what students universally do, which is really interesting. Well, it's not interesting, it's obvious, I suppose. And sometimes you think it would have been really nice if they'd been able to, and you, hopefully there would be people that they could speak to who would say, look, the courts won't look at this. You haven't really got a case unless you can say that there was some kind of process not followed or whatever, not just that you're not happy with your mark. It could be worked through with him rather than the student just going straight into the court process, which costs them a lot of money. I think he had to pay quite a bit of costs.
$8,000.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so what did the judge decide in this case?
The judge didn't feel that the case had substance enough for it to be reviewed. And I'm sure behind the judge's thinking would have been all the precedents there are from around the world, really, and the general feeling that courts won't go into matters of academic judgment, that that's better left for the universities and the academics concerned.
Associate Professor Philip Dawson, who's based at the Centre for Research in Assessment and Digital Learning at Deakin University, says Chinmay's argument was around the assessment process and how his request for a marking review was handled.
He claimed that it wasn't actually double marked by different people. Monash has maintained that it was double marked by different people. The court had this really interesting conversation about whether they even had sort of jurisdiction to talk about academic standards like that. They could make a judgment over the process, perhaps, but not over the standards.
Justice Melinda Richards said when she basically dismissed the case and ordered him to pay $8,000 in costs, she said, quote, I encourage you to move on, end quote. I understand you will be disappointed by this outcome, but it is not the end of the world to fail an assignment. So some kind of wise words from the judge there.
Yeah, I think that's excellent advice. I mean, most of us have failed an assignment. I failed an assignment. I imagine you failed an assignment.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a common thing, and we all do need to take that judge's advice and move on.
Sally Varnum says cases like that of Chinmay Naik, which focused on the fairness of the marking process, are extremely rare.
Well, on the face of it, they are. But in fact, there are a reasonable lot of cases that are argued on disability grounds, on discrimination grounds. And quite often behind the allegation of discrimination is academic judgment.
Indeed, you sent me a list of reported decisions of courts and tribunals involving universities and university students, and I was a bit shocked. It's 20 pages long. You're telling me that rather than that being a straightforward difference of opinion over what an assignment or a test result should be, it's normally couched in other terms like disability discrimination or racial discrimination or something along those lines.
Or gender discrimination.
That a lot of these cases on this 20-page list, they're disability discrimination issues. I'm imagining physical disability will be somewhat straightforward to deal with. Things like ADHD,
anxiety, chronic fatigue syndrome. Do these create certain complications?
Absolutely. When you talk with these disputes grievance officers from universities, more and more, I haven't been involved with it for a few years, but there was more and more discussion about students with anxiety problems, with all sorts of mental health issues, and how the universities can navigate their way around the support mechanisms, their special considerations that students are given. I'm not absolutely sure where it's all going.
And the question is, to what degree should universities accommodate the people with special needs?
I know. If you were going to be really pragmatic, you would say that, say, for example, someone who's studying medicine or someone who's studying law, where they're going to be put on the line to do things quickly and professionally and whatever, how does it help them if they've got through university having special considerations all the time for their anxiety and their whatever? And that's a huge question, and it raises all sorts of issues of equity that I don't really want to go into, and I'm not offering a view either way.
There also seem to be a lot of cases which are focusing on allegations of race discrimination. Why is that?
I think that if a student is dissatisfied, then it's seen as a reason why they were treated in such a way, and so their cases are hung on some sort of discrimination if they're in a minority group or whatever. I can't really comment on discrimination in universities. I would hate to think that there is, in this day and age, discrimination in assessment areas or whatever on any sort of basis. And I'm not commenting also on whether they have a valid complaint or not, but yeah, I think there is a lot of forum shopping among, in some particular cases of students. There was one particular case that I won't name. But this student went to, it was a few years ago, and she went to anti-discrimination tribunals. She went to federal and state ombuds. She went to, well, state ombuds, I think. She went to administrative appeal tribunal. She went to state courts, federal courts, and everywhere.
What I was very interested was in this 20-page list that there were a considerable number of highly litigious students who each had commenced multiple legal actions. I don't know if this is the same one you're mentioning, or you're talking about here, but there was one student who had 22 separate legal proceedings. So we're talking about, in some cases, no doubt most don't fall into this category, but there are some vexatious litigants. I mean, are you comfortable with that term?
I suppose, yeah. I mean, part of me thinks that for a student to want to, for example, like Mr. Naik, to want to go to all that, to put all that time and energy into pursuing something through a court or a tribunal, then they must genuinely feel that they have grounds for their grievance. Someone suggested a long time ago that maybe all universities should just have an office where students can get some sort of legal advice like this that would work through the merits of their case with them and maybe help towards reaching some sort of agreement or mediation with the university, rather than they're just going off by themselves and committing themselves to all this time and energy and anxiety and money in trying to seek justice.
Sally Varnum, so far we've been talking about students challenging academic decisions, but of course there's also a huge issue around disciplinary procedures, where there are allegations around academic misconduct, cheating or plagiarism. Now the consequences can be absolutely dire. Not only can you be expelled from a tertiary institution, international students can be kicked out of the country. In 2016, there was a case where a Pakistani student had his visa revoked by the Administrative Appeals Tribunal.
That is, it's a very interesting case, isn't it? And apparently, I read somewhere that there were 9,000 student visas cancelled last year, and a sizable proportion of them for plagiarism or contract cheating or some other kind of academic misconduct.
And what did this bloke, Shahrya Khan, originally from Pakistan, what did he do?
Well, what it seems that he did was that he basically had got through his course, it was a TAFE course, I think, had got through all the subjects in his course by cutting and pasting from the internet. Well, that was the allegation. And reading his judgment, I think that it wasn't helped by the fact that his appeal against the cancellation of his visa that was before the AAT, he didn't really take responsibility. He spent a lot of time accusing the college of all sorts of lack of processes and what they should have told him he could do and couldn't do, etc. I think that didn't do him. He and his agent, who was, I gather, sort of appearing with him, didn't do themselves any favour by those kind of allegations.
Professor Sally Varnum, based at UTS Law School. On RN, Radio Australia, News Radio, or available as a podcast, this is The Law Report. I'm Damien Carrick. Plagiarism comes in many forms. There's the cut and paste without attribution variety, and as Philip Dawson explains, there's also the phenomenon of contract cheating.
So contract cheating is essentially when you get someone else to do the work for you. Typically, this involves paying someone through an online website to actually construct the task for you. This is really different to the old days of copy-paste plagiarism, where, you know, we could see that this text has been reproduced from elsewhere. Some software could really tell us, oh, this chunk of text was copy-pasted off the web or off this story or whatever. So it's actually paying for a bespoke piece of assessment to be written for you.
Okay, so what do we know about the organisations that offer these contract cheating services? You know, where are they based? How big are they? Who do they employ to do this work?
Contract cheating services are big global entities. There are little bespoke ones that might operate near a particular university campus, but there are also massive organisations that have hundreds of different shop fronts on the web that they recruit students. We know it's worth something in the order of $300 or $400 million a year. We also know that a lot of these sites purport to be, say, an Australian contract cheating website, and they use a lot of Australian language in their advertising, but really they're located overseas in countries like India or China.
You work at Deakin University, and in 2016, you know, it made the headlines when the university expelled, I think, 13 engineering students from the university, and that was for contract cheating, wasn't it?
Yes, that was for contract cheating, and in response, the university's taken a whole bunch of different approaches, a lot of really strong partnerships with the Student Association around awareness raising that contract cheating is not an acceptable thing, some great strengthening of the disciplinary processes, and also a program of research into trying to understand why might students contract cheat, how could we detect contract cheating, and sort of other impacts of it.
Okay, let's come to that detection issue because that's your area. You've done one study where you tried to measure how well academic markers can identify if an assignment has been generated by a contract cheating company. What did you find?
Yeah, we've done a couple of studies where we've looked at contract cheating assignments. We've actually obtained these from the contract cheating websites, and we've asked markers to identify if they're contract cheating or not. So we've given them a bundle of, say, 20 assignments, and we've said these are assignments from a subject you've marked in a lot. Which ones do you think are contract cheating, and which ones do you think are not contract cheating? And across our two studies, there's a rate of about 60% detection rate for people who haven't had any special training in what contract cheating is. They've just been asked to find it. This varies from other work where people have just been given assignments and not asked to spot contract cheating, and they've tended not to spot contract cheating in previous studies. When you're not looking for it, you don't find it.
Okay, so it seems like a lot of this stuff is getting through. It's getting through undetected. You've also done other work following on from that first study where you've tried to train people to identify contract cheating. Once they've undergone that training, what are the results then?
Yeah, so we've found that when people undergo training, and it's not a really long amount of training, it's about a sort of a 3-hour workshop that we've done with them, about 80% of the time they spot the contract cheated work. You could look at that as 20% of the time it's still getting through, but if I thought there was an 80% chance I'm going to get caught for contract cheating with the very severe penalties that exist, there's no way I would do it.
What about software? Can you plug in a particular assignment, push it through some kind of software check? Are those sorts of detection measures effective?
Yeah, so in the past we've used Turnitin's text matching software and software by other companies to find that sort of copy-paste. These contract cheating websites will often give you a Turnitin report stating that the assignment is plagiarism free.
Wow. So they say, here it is, we've pushed it through this Turnitin system and it's undetectable.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in response, Turnitin and some other companies have been producing new softwares to try and detect contract cheating, to try and see, is this piece of work different to the pieces of work someone's produced in the past?
So realistically, a lot of this cheating is going to pass undetected.
I think a lot of it has been in the past, but I think less of it is getting through now, and much less will get through in the future with training, with awareness raising, and with special software.
Now, Associate Professor Phil Dawson, I know your expertise and your area of interest is around detection, but do you know much about the regulatory framework? Do any countries actually outlaw these contract cheating firms or businesses?
Yes, so at the moment there's legislation being discussed in the UK around that. There's a lot of great public debate. There's also legislation enacted in New Zealand. Initially, I thought this will be completely toothless and it won't have any enforcement. But recently, the New Zealand police settled out of court for a sum of $2 million with assignments for you. I mean, they'd actually raised 4.6 million New Zealand dollars through selling their services, so they didn't lose all their money. But yeah, that shows there are very significant penalties for organisations that provide contract cheating services in New Zealand.
And is there a conversation in Australia about adopting New Zealand-style laws?
Yeah, look, there is. There are some strong advocates of it. I'm unsure, to be honest. I worry that we may push this sort of behaviour underground into places where we won't have the sort of oversight over students. I'm really concerned this may end up something that's conducted on the dark web using anonymous payment types like Bitcoin. And the dark web is not somewhere that I want to be pushing our students to. You can buy all sorts of stuff on the dark web once you start looking for essays.
You're saying that it might be a gateway to other forms of antisocial or criminal behaviour.
Yeah, we know that on the dark web people are hiring hitmen or buying heroin or all sorts of things like that. The intense anonymity that the dark web affords would provide a great cover for contract cheating as well. At the moment, there's not a lot of contract cheating going on the dark web because it's not illegal. I think we're not exposing students to those same risks. I'm obviously very anti-contract cheating, but I'm not sure that making it illegal is the way to go.
Associate Professor Philip Dawson from Deakin University. So, how prevalent is cheating? Associate Professor Tracy Bretag is based at the School of Management at the University of South Australia. Her team surveyed 15,000 students about different forms of cheating, such as obtaining an assignment to submit as your own, which includes contract cheating, also receiving or giving exam assistance, and exam impersonation, either taking an exam for someone else or having them do that for you.
It's really hard to put numbers on it. We think we have the largest data set in the world, and 6% of our students admitted to engaging in one of those five cheating behaviours. We also asked staff if they had ever engaged in those cheating behaviours, and 10% of them said they had when they were students. So probably the number is something like 5 to 10. Different studies, depending on the sample size, will give you different numbers, and it ranges. One study found 3%. A study in the Czech Republic found 7%. In some countries like Ghana or Georgia, the numbers can go up to 25, 28, 40%. So it depends on the country. It depends on the sample size. But what we can say, because we have such a large data set, we can say in the Australian context that 6% of students self-report engaging in those behaviours. Now, that might seem like a relatively small number, but if we think about a tutorial, say 20 students, that means one or two students in that room are obtaining an assignment from someone else to submit as their own. And our concern is that that will become normal. With every student being inundated, I spoke to a student the other day who said in one day they'd had 5 offers from cheat sites to write their work. And this was a very good student who would never take advantage of that. But if you're a struggling student, English is not your first language, you can see how that might be the way to get through.
I've been told that sometimes these contract cheating sites will even maybe blackmail students who've engaged their services. Have you heard of that?
I have heard anecdotal evidence of that. I don't know how prevalent that is. I think the issue is less about them being blackmailed by the service and more that they're going to graduate with a degree which means absolutely nothing and doesn't equip them for professional practice. And even if they do manage to get a job, they're going to put, you know, society, the public at risk, whether they're a journalist, a business person, a doctor, an engineer, you know, that's the really big issue. And for the students themselves, they've cheated themselves out of the opportunity to transform their lives through learning.
And how often do universities like yours actually expel students for academic misconduct?
Well, I wouldn't want to give any numbers because, of course, that would be confidential. But I can say that, you know, we don't hold back. The reasons a student might be suspended, for example, is if they have, as I said, engaged with a contract cheating service, and they will be suspended in every case for a minimum of a major study period of 6 months. If they do it again, and I've seen examples of this, they'll be expelled.
And is it always clear when people are cheating at that extreme level? I mean, is it easy to establish?
It's not easy to establish. It actually takes a lot of resources, to be honest. And you have to gather quite a bit of evidence, both textual and personal. You have to meet with the student, you know, all of these things. It takes time. But if you collect all the evidence and you believe you've substantiated a case on the balance of probabilities, because that's the civil burden of proof, then you can proceed with an appropriate outcome. And we've done that, and we've had very few appeals against our decisions, and none of those appeals have been upheld. So you really have to put the time in. And as you should, if you're going to suspend or expel a student, you want to be very sure about the evidence and that the case, you know, holds up.
We're talking about disciplinary processes here and suspensions or expulsions from universities. There's a debate right now at the moment about how best to deal with allegations of sexual assault or sexual misconduct, maybe sexual harassment, involving two university students. How do you see that debate and how those sorts of issues should be resolved? Should they be resolved through these disciplinary processes?
This is not my area of expertise. My area of expertise is academic integrity, but I have thought about it because I've been watching those cases with interest, and the reason I've been interested is they've been substantiating their cases on the balance of probabilities, and that's what we do, as I mentioned, for academic misconduct. But I've been a little surprised, you know, sexual assault and rape are criminal offences. They're not civil matters. So I would have to believe that the burden of proof should be beyond reasonable doubt in the interest of, you know, natural justice for both victim and perpetrator or alleged perpetrator. So I was surprised they're using the balance of probabilities and they're using internal processes to substantiate those cases. And I'm concerned by that.
So you think that the best way, when there's an allegation of sexual assault or sexual harassment or other inappropriate sexual behaviour, the best way is to actually call in the police?
Obviously, I believe the victims should call the police because that's their right and their role. I think the university should take proactive measures to support the student through that process. It might mean some interventions, for example, while the case is going on, for example, to make sure that the victim is not in the same classroom or doesn't have to be on the same campus as the alleged perpetrator. And I absolutely think we need to do more to support victims in this case and to prevent that from happening. We need real professional development and training. We need a change of culture on campus for sure. But I don't think the university, with the processes and policies we have in place at the moment, have the capacity to deal with what is essentially a crime. The other thing I was interested to notice is that in these cases of sexual assault, one of the outcomes in some universities is that the alleged perpetrator can lose academic credit, having their degrees rescinded, for example. So I'm not quite sure how that works either, because it's an academic matter. You deal with an academic misconduct policy. A criminal matter gets dealt with by the police and through a code of conduct, a student code of conduct. But I think they're blurring in a way that makes me uncomfortable.
Associate Professor Tracy Bretag from the University of South Australia. But others take a different view. Penina Levine is a lecturer at Curtin University Law School.
What I think, Damien, is that there's got to be the right balance struck between fairness to the student who's been accused and the maintenance of the university's reputation and integrity, along with, most importantly, the risk of harm to other students. What has to be remembered is that what the university is investigating is whether there's been a knowing breach of their policy, which is likely to result in a risk being posed to others. They're not investigating whether a criminal offence has been committed. Whether a criminal offence has been committed needs to be determined beyond reasonable doubt by a criminal court. Now, if you look at the University of Sydney's policy in light of the recent media attention that's been given to it, you'll see that they will only investigate an allegation if it appears that there's an imminent risk to the health and safety of others. So if once they investigate it, they find that on the balance of probabilities, that is, it's more likely than not that there's been a breach of the university policy, meaning that there's a likely risk to other students, then it will take appropriate action to remove that risk.
But can it remove that risk through measures which make sure the complainant is safe and supported without going the next step of removing or punishing somebody on the balance of probabilities?
I'm sure that if they can actually ensure that the complainant is supported and that there's no other risk to others, then it will do that.
Because I think the conversation here is around, are people being expelled or suspended from a university on the basis of a balance of probabilities test around what is, at the end of the day, a criminal matter where you would need to really establish something beyond reasonable doubt before you start punishing somebody in this way?
But I think that's where the confusion is, because they're not making it a determination on whether or not a criminal matter has occurred. They're making a determination on whether or not the university code of conduct policies and rules have been contravened.
But expulsion or suspension is a very, very serious matter. Expulsion, for instance, could have huge consequences for somebody's life.
And I think that if we're looking at a punishment of expulsion, you would find that most investigation committees would not have any reasonable doubt before imposing that penalty. But if we're talking about suspension or other penalty, then I think it's fair that they decide whether or not there has been a breach of university policy and rules on the balance of probabilities.
So you're saying when it comes to suspension, they should be able to decide that on balance of probabilities?
Yes.
They have a duty of care to their students, to their staff, to both the complainant and to other students who may find themselves dealing with the person against whom the allegations are made. It's all about safety for the people coming forward and for other people. But can you then go the next step of actually excluding somebody, having a huge consequence to their life without first finding them guilty beyond reasonable doubt?
Look, there are civil consequences that are determined on the balance of probabilities that are serious themselves. Whilst the suspension is serious, it's not incarceration, and the person is not going to have a criminal record. I think universities, as I said, have to strike the right balance between fairness to the student who's been accused and the maintenance of the university's reputation and integrity, along with protecting the other students.
But they'd always be able to take steps to make people safe, right?
Would they, without suspending the other student in certain circumstances? If they are able to make someone feel safe and they are able to remove the risk to other students, I'm sure they would be taking that into account when making their determination.
Penina Levine, lecturer at Curtin University Law School. That's the program for this week. A big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and also to sound engineer this week, Tim Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.